So, Doug, there's so much going on in this scenario. We could probably spend three roundtables talking about it. But I want to dial in on something you made a real point of emphasizing in your response, which is asserting your authority as pilot in command. And one of the aspects was, as soon as you contact departure, requesting that turn on course as soon as possible, or as soon as practical, maybe. Who are you asserting your authority for? Is this for you? Is it to ATC? Why is that so important if procedurally it's probably going to have no effect whatsoever on how soon you get a turn?
Well, I'll agree with you completely. It really has procedurally nothing to do with it. I'm going to get the turn when ATC is ready to give it to me. But I think, and especially John, you would probably concur with me because you've been sitting on the other side of that microphone, being a supervisor at the TRACON and whatnot. And I think you would concur that most controllers get a great sense of what they're dealing with in the pilot in that very first call-up that the pilot makes to ATC.
Absolutely. And, you know, the first thing that you want to do, obviously, as you an IFR pilot, you expect them to be able to follow your instructions, but they don't want you going the wrong way any more than you do. You know, the quickest way to get rid of somebody is get them out of your airspace and point them to somewhere else and get them going. So there's not a lot of, some people may think that controllers enjoy penalty vectors, but there's not a lot of joy in making a guy go round and round in circles or go the wrong way.
Right, right. So one of the reasons, and perhaps the first reason, the most important reason, is that this is letting the controller know that I know what I'm doing and I know what has to be done, as opposed to the pilot is, hey, SoCal, it's me. Here I am. I want ATC. I want that controller to know that I'm aware of what's going on. I know what I want to do, and I'm prepared to do it when he tells me it's okay to do it. Okay. The other thing is, in saying asserting, I certainly find, as you know, I do these trips up and down the East Coast, and I thought when I started doing them that I'd be getting pilots who were working on their instrument rating and were preparing for that and then would finish up the test by testing with me. The vast majority of the clients who come to me are already rated and they're looking to gain confidence in flying in the system. And the biggest take home, I think, that most of the pilots training with me get is the fact that they are in command. When I say assert, some people take it as if I'm being aggressive. It's not that, but it's creating a mentality within a pilot to know that ultimately you're in charge and don't be afraid to ask for what you want and what you need.
Yeah, I guess I fall sort of somewhere in between three and four here. Certainly you want to be on the same page with ATC and let them know what you want, but I feel like checking in with a request to go direct when able isn't communicating very much because they know that you don't want to go the wrong way and that you'd love direct if you could get it. So, I mean, I think if I thought they were forgetting about me at some point, I'd certainly ask, but I'm not sure. I feel like if I check in with, and I'd like direct when able, they're going to think, well, yeah, we knew that, but maybe I'm along for the ride.
Again, I'm looking at this. And when I said this as the point of, this is a brand new instrument pilot. He's had his rating for 1 month. Okay. And this guy is probably, because he's totally freaked out by all of this. He doesn't even really know what he's supposed to be doing. He's having a hard time with all of that. And when he makes that first communication with ATC, he might even do it just SoCal, it's Cessna 12345. And that's it. And that's all they say. Because he's still learning. And that's, to me, the difference between it. And again, I've had many controllers tell me, that very first check-in, they know what they're dealing with. It's not really a critical thing. It's not a big thing. But
yeah, Doug, I agree. You know, I fly up and down the East Coast a lot like you do, and I fly once in a great while in California, and I get confused out there with all the frequency changes. But coming up and down the East Coast, a lot of complex airspace, and the controllers are busy. And so it's not that they forget about you, but you may not be their priority. And so just reminding them gently, from time to time, that you are asking for a particular thing, whether it's a reminder for a descent, as you know, you have your descent planning going on and they're busy and they may have a reason for keeping you high. But if you certainly can say, you know, requesting lower, when you getting to the point that you think you should be descending, or asking for direct, or, you know, those kind of reminders from time to time. You don't need to be obnoxious about it, or, you know, real persistent. And you can tell after a while with a little experience about whether they're paying close attention to you or not and going to be able to meet your needs. But it is a point about being, you know, pilot in command and making decisions and remembering that ATC works for you. They're there to help facilitate your flight. And so it's I fly with a lot of pilots who just kind of sit back and whatever ATC says is, my gosh, you know, that's gospel and we must do it. Well, yeah, you know, you are expected to do what they tell you unless you negotiate something else. And oftentimes with you can be a little persuasive and you can get some things that work better for you.
Tom, we're exactly on the exact same page. An example, I use vertical speed required quite often, just in knowing when to plan my descent, just to say, oh, it's coming up. I need 500 feet a minute now, because, you know, I have, if there's numbers over 10, I got to fly barefoot. I'm numerically challenged, so I need all the help I can get. I'll use vertical speed required. It's coming up. I need 500 feet a minute now to make that initial fix or to make the intermediate fix. I'll request it. The same thing I use cross-track error. How often have we seen that the heading that we're getting on vectors on that downwind is drifting us in closer and closer and closer, and ATC isn't saying anything? If the learner understands their pilot in command, it's time to say, looks like we're drifting in pretty close. We need 10 to the left. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to make the 90 and then the 30. We're going to be doing a steep 180 to capture the glide, to capture the inbound approach course. So you and I are in lockstep on this, Tom.
This scenario raises an area of concern for me, and that is that departure procedures in general are underemphasized in training and proficiency. Step back for a moment. You know, in training, we focus on the approaches, but even to maintain your IFR currency or to complete an IPC, there's no explicit requirement that you have to fly departure procedures. And most of us get pretty lazy. You take off, you fly runway heading, you get vectors on your way, you go. But situations like this make it really important that you understand ODPs and where to find that information. And then it goes into the planning part of the whole scenario. This business of just filing direct and then seeing what ATC gives you is really not a good strategy for launching on a flight, especially in unfamiliar airspace with pressure. You should plan something. And today, you know, with most of the apps that we use for our flight planning, you're going to get an expected route, or you're going to be able to see routes that ATC has recently cleared. A few minutes looking at that will really help you get an idea of what to expect, or at least become a little bit more familiar with the environment around the airport and what you might then encounter if ATC throws you a curve.
Yeah, I agree, Bruce. That was exactly going to be my comment. This pilot could have prepared a lot better for this departure, especially being a new pilot, a new instrument pilot. He's certainly in unfamiliar territory here in this airspace. And as Ryan suggested early on, a walk into the FBO and say, gosh, I'm a new instrument pilot and I'm going to file down here to Brown Field. And is there anybody I could talk to that might tell me what I could expect? Number one. And then, Bruce, as you alluded to, most of our iPad apps nowadays have a route advisor on there. And if you take a look at that, it's going to show you that you're going to go to Robin on this departure. So that should not have been a surprise to our pilot.
That was a lot of what I was going to say. Doug, I think, makes a great point about getting local knowledge. And one of the clues that it would be useful here is there are actually some previously cleared routes that are just direct here. And so you could pick that. But if you actually study the airspace and the terrain that's around here, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you're going to take off and get turned direct. And so just a simple call to the FBO, or you're there, just check in and ask. Someone's going to tell you you're going to Robin, or you're going to get cleared to Robin and maybe not go all the way there.
So a couple of things. The ODP in this case is really more of what we call a paper stop or a paper route. It's just a way to get you off and get you going in a direction that's probably away from other traffic or another final approach course or something like that. ATC, you know, as I said before, they don't want you going the wrong way any more than you do. You don't have to climb to the MVA also. Whatever the MVA in that area is, a terminal facility can vector a departure right off the ground. And we get that all the time. You know, radar contact, turn left heading, whatever, way below the MVA, as long as they can separate you from displayed obstacles on the video map. So chances of actually doing this are pretty slim. But the other thing I wanted to touch on is Doug's theme about being pilot in command. And one of our sometime contributors, Tom Turner from the American Bonanza Society, he publishes a weekly newsletter, Flying Lessons. And in there, he talks about the four stripes of being a pilot in command. And there's four phases to being that pilot in command. Those same four stripes that a captain wears: and mastery of your ship, mastery of your environment, all those. And I think that's where Doug's going with this. It's not so much the you're trying to be a jerk by telling them, you know, this is what I want. It's more about being in charge and being mastery of your environment and not just an interested observer.
Tom, I'm going to defer to you because you might be going the same place I will. So I'm going to defer to you. And then if you don't go there, I'll come back in.
I just want to go back to the whole planning thing. You know, this is a short flight. And short flights, particularly as you move up in performance, and 172, it seems like almost a lot of flights are kind of long. But when you move up in a higher performance airplane, move up to a higher performance airplane, things start to happen more quickly. And so particularly for short flights, it's a good reminder that those you need to spend extra time planning for, because things happen really quickly and you need to not be afraid to ask for help. I had a situation not that long ago where there was a fellow flying a Citation out of Frederick to Penn State up in Pennsylvania. Not a very long flight at all, in a jet. And it was a lot of busy airspace between there, and the weather was it was okay. It wasn't terrible or anything, but it was kind of marginal. And so he was just asked somebody. He was a very experienced pilot, single pilot, typed in the airplane. But he asked somebody else to go along with him, and I put my hand up and went, and I did it for the right seat, and worked the radios and helped out. And it was a busy flight in a jet, even though it was a relatively short one. So it's just a reminder that short flights sometimes take more work to prepare for than a long flight, particularly if you're in complicated airspace, and certainly when you're in complicated airspace that you're not familiar with.
Absolutely, Tom. And let's just think about that Lear crash at Teterboro. There's a classic example of that. I would just like to address very quickly dealing with foreflight and looking for expected routes. I'm sure every one of us has filed something. We've done a lot of studying and we've come up what we think is the absolute best route that works for us to where we want to get. And we file that, and then we get the notice from foreflight, or we've even used something that they've suggested, but we filed something. We get a notice, expect this route. And then it asks, do you want to accept that? And we click yes. We put that in. So now we've gotten rid of what we filed. And now we call clearance delivery, and we'll either get something that's entirely different or cleared as filed. And now we've already wiped out what we filed, and now we're sitting there scrambling as well. And it's just a caution that it's a great tool, but still be aware, being in command, what you want, what you filed, and what you're expecting.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, something else that you said here, Doug, about not negotiating with clearance delivery on the ground and negotiating with departure once you're in the air. In a situation like this, it's obvious. But I could see, especially for a newer pilot, a situation where it's a little more of an issue. Imagine that there was just nasty weather, a small cell or something in that general direction. And now the pilot's really nervous about going that way at all. Like, man, right after getting off the ground, I don't want to keep going in that direction. Do you still wait and get in the air and negotiate with departure? Or do you say at that point, you know, I can't even accept this because I can only go a couple miles, let alone several miles, before I'm just completely uncomfortable with that situation, the weather, or even the direction it might be moving? Is there a point where there's a balance?
There's a significant difference between negotiating and not accepting. There's a very significant, you know, if there's weather out there, or there's, or let's say that the ODP has, it really wouldn't necessarily be an ODP. Let's say, though, that we've got a departure, a SID that has a crossing restriction, and your aircraft doesn't have the performance capability to make that crossing restriction. Then you have to definitely refuse the clearance. I think part of the fact that I tried to make here is that once you read that clearance back, you've basically signed the contract. You're accepting it. But I learned my lesson early on as an instrument pilot. I remember I was in Lynchburg trying to go up to Gaithersburg. And I wanted to go direct Martinsburg direct, pretty much. It was really short and fast. And I got this routing, probably you've gotten this as well, Tom. They want to take you around the east side of Baltimore to get back into Gaithersburg. Yeah. And I argued with ground controller. And he said, look, either you take this clearance or you go VFR. He said, this is what I have to assign. And that's when I learned. And that, so I accepted it. And as soon as I was handed to Potomac, any chance direct Martinsburg, clear direct.
Yeah, lots of times if you can get to Potomac or an approach controller like that, you can have a little bit of flexibility. I had a similar situation coming up from the south, past Roanoke and into the D.C. area. And there was a big storm just kind of to the northwest of Roanoke, and they have a letter of agreement at Roanoke with Potomac that they're going to put airplanes coming into the Potomac airspace from the south on a particular route, particularly at low altitude airplanes, and it's off to the west. And so that's what the Roanoke controller gave me. What is he was directed to give me this turn that was going to put me right in the middle of this cell that I was looking at that had a lot of magenta in it. And guess what? I'm not going there. And so he gave me the clearance, and I said, unable. The weather's bad. And he said, well, I've got, we have to put you on that route because that's our agreement with Potomac. And I said, well, it's not acceptable. I'm not going there. You need to come up with another solution. And sure enough, he came back in a couple of minutes and cleared me on the exact route that I already had filed and was in the box. And then gave me a clearance to make a left turn when I got past the cell. So it all worked out fine. And as soon as I got handed off Potomac, they were very cooperative and that sort of thing. So you need to understand sort of these agreements exist between different air traffic control facilities where a controller in one facility, you know, is told this is how you hand off airplanes on a particular route to another facility. And that's going to be their go-to solution. And if most days that may work out just fine, but when weather becomes an issue, you need to be prepared to say no and go a different direction.
This is exactly being pilot of command, Tom. And this is the thing that you and I and everyone else on this panel knows. But the new pilot quite often is afraid to make any kind of a request. It's just, yes, sir.
I just wanted to go back and tag on to what Tom said about short flights often require way more preparation than a long flight. Back in the day before iPads and things, when we used Jepsen charts, I used to fly an airliner between San Francisco and San Jose. It's about a 10-minute flight, and I would get out all the departures out of San Francisco and the likely approaches in San Francisco for a return, and then the arrivals for San Jose and the approaches, and then we would fly that thing, and the paper would fly around the cockpit so much. By the time I got there, it took me longer to clean up the paper than it did to fly the plane. So,
yeah, I could totally see that. It's an interesting point about this being such a complicated flight. And it being so short at the same time. And I don't think there's anyone on this panel who thinks going VFR would have been the right option, because we all understand that the IFR in this airspace and in these weather conditions is going to be far safer as long as you trust it can work with the system. But in a place where there was less complication in the airspace, I think there actually would be a real temptation to just ditch this, I can't deal with it, and scud run along, the fear of working with the system. And while I don't think it's something we can go into in great detail in this discussion, it makes me think, you know, is this flight, this short flight, essentially too much for a neophyte pilot? Or is it that it's just going to be when you're new, when you're learning in the system, you need to take that extra step in the real world and check all your routes in ForeFlight, ask the questions that you need to ask, trust in ATC, but verify, if you will. You know, I really need to get going to Brownfield in the politest, most appropriate, and succinct way possible work with the system in a way that keeps you safe, but also clears up any ambiguities and things that you might really be wondering about.
That's how you build experience, is by taking on flights like this. The challenge here is that maybe the pilot didn't do as much preparation as he could have, but there's certainly no reason that a pilot like that can't or shouldn't make a flight like that, because that's how you build experience and learn things. And I see too often instrument pilots who their skills atrophy because, particularly around decision making, is because they don't fly enough. They don't stretch their skills, and they just fly only in very, very benign instrument conditions without really challenging themselves.
Well, it sounds like the big takeaway here is that no matter what, no matter how small the flight seems or how innocuous it may be, it can have these corners that'll catch you. And preparation, preparation, and then preparation. And then a lot of flexibility once you're in the air, both from you and seeing what kind of flexibility ATC has to do what you need to get on your way.